Okay, today is August 29th, 2014. This is the first interview with Peter Rickman. We're going to talk to him about his time in graduate school and specifically about his involvement in the 2011 protests at the Capitol. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Peter, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure, it's Peter Rickman, R-I-C-K-M-A-N.
Okay. I'm going to take just a quick peek here and see where we're at volume-wise. I can turn it up a little bit. Okay. So we should be fine.
Great.
So, Peter, as I mentioned before we turn this on, the first question is, why come to UW-Madison?
For graduate and law school. So I grew up in Wisconsin, in northeast Wisconsin, in the city of Neenah. And I went, I did what I, you know, call my years abroad. I went to undergraduate in Miami University in Ohio. Mm. And to this day, I think if there was one thing I could change about something that, you know, I've made a major life decision on, is probably that I would have gone to UW-Madison for undergraduate education. It's such a fantastic institution. I, after undergrad and working... doing organizing work and social movement organizing work, decided that I wanted to go to graduate school and law school to be able to build some of the technical skills that, you know, it seemed to me were desperately necessary in a dying labor movement that needed to figure out new ways to organize and build power for working people. So after making the decision and convincing my my lady friend and fiance that it was okay for me to go to grad and law school, made a decision to go to UW-Madison for a couple reasons. One, it would be the least expensive. Two, it would have the highest possibility for funding, most likely. And... there would be a chance while going to school and working here to be part of a venerable graduate student workers union in the Teaching Assistants Association. And that was actually a really important thing to me as someone who'd be working, but as also someone who has, for his adult life, made activism in social movements, and particularly in the union movement, the labor movement, a really central core part of who I am.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, did I hear you right? Did you do some work in undergraduate in terms of social movements and social activism?
I did not mention that, but it was pretty minimal. When I went to undergrad, I paid my way through college and worked a number of different jobs at different times, and so I was not particularly involved on my own campus. You know, supported a certain number of different things, but was never heavily involved, and certainly not in any sort of leadership role on campus. I worked university food service, you know, like not one of the student learner jobs, but like one of the jobs they hire people from the rest of the world to do. Yeah. And I worked in a dining hall for a while and had a pretty, there was a pretty important experience that I had at that point in time. At the school where I was, Miami University, there was very nearly right after the time that I ended up quitting the job because I had made enough money to get through the semester and I wanted to just focus on the school stuff. there started to be a pretty significant amount of unrest amongst the food service workers and clerical workers on campus because they were going through contract negotiations. And ultimately it led to a strike of the campus workers. And I happened to be in a human resource management class at the time where I had a professor who had worked for the National Labor Relations Board and took a lot of pride in being a third-party neutral on labor relations issues. And he encouraged us and provided, you know, sort of like, not extra credit, but, you know, credit for work in the class to go and you know, immerse ourselves in one part of the strike or another, and, you know, observe, you know, picket lines and talk to people there, go to fora being held on campus about this. And that in of itself, I mean, that was my introduction to the union movement, but it was a really formative thing because these are people I just worked side by side with. And but for the accident of having made, you know, enough money already to get myself through the semester, I would have been right there with them, and it would have been, you know, a fairly radicalizing experience, I think. But, you know, when I was on campus, you know, it was working and going to school as an undergraduate, and, you know, it was more things like that where I was supporting people who were doing what they were doing because, you know, made a choice about how to use my time. And maybe some of that led me to make a personal choice later on that, you know, it was important to be on the front lines in the in the struggle.
Mm-hmm. Peter, can we back up again and talk mm-hmm. a little bit about your growing up in Neenah?
Yeah.
What did your parents
do? My dad bargained for management on the opposite side of the table from my mom's union. My dad had spent a few, by the time he retired a couple years ago, he had spent a few decades working in the technical college system here in Wisconsin, and originally started as a teacher and was on the union bargaining committee, and it turned out he was so good at it, the management wanted to hire him to be on their side. And he spent his career doing, you know, labor relations and human resources work for the technical college system, Fox Valley Technical College, which also happened to be a place where my mom worked, secretary and helping teach administrative assistant classes. And, you know, my dad had joked all the time about that pink Okami rag, the NEA newsletter. And for anyone who knows much about unions, they're far from it. So it was, you know, sort of tongue in cheek and, you know, poking my mom. You know, I heard about unions and collective bargaining at the dinner table growing up. And to me, it was just sort of a normal thing. You know, when my dad was preparing for negotiations, he'd have all his stuff laid out across the table. And it was, you know, a really intense thing for him. But it was like, that, you know, that's what you do. And, you know, he was never bad rapping the union. And, you know, I learned from him that, like, collective bargaining was where he felt like they solved problems as opposed to the source of problems. And, you know, it stuck with me. And, you know, I like to say that I knew early on, growing up, having heard the proverbial both sides, I knew which side I was on. And, you know, some of that came from also growing up in the in the Catholic Church and having some exposure to Catholic social teaching. Which is pretty clear and unequivocal, even more so than many of the world religions, is as far as prioritizing workers and respecting the dignity of the individual worker and having that manifest itself and the importance of collective action, collective rights, and the role of unions and in a democratic society. And so that sort of general experience growing up, along with, you know, having read some books and then working for a living, you know, working in a plastic plant, working in food service, as a janitor, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. sort of forms your political view of the world as far as, you know, which side you're on.
Mm-hmm. So, graduate school and law school, what school or department did you want to get your graduate degree in?
I was a dual degree student in the law school and the La Follette School of Public Affairs. And I dropped out before I finished either of them.
Okay.
Which relates to all the stuff we're talking about here. There's a very clear connection.
Right. So what fall did you matriculate here? What year?
It would have been 2008.
And did you immediately become interested in being involved in the TAA at that point?
Signed a card before I even came to campus. Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, I also took a couple of part-time classes the spring and the fall previous to that, just to make sure that being back in school was something I felt like I could mentally handle.
So how long had you been, how long was the gap between undergraduate and going back to graduate school then?
4 or 5 years, something like that.
And were you at Is Miami of Ohio in a town called Miami?
It's in Oxford, Ohio.
Right. Okay. So were you in Oxford for that time? Or were you...
No. Spent another year living in Chicago, and then I was living in Madison here before that.
Oh, okay.
By the way, we like to say that Miami was a university when Florida still belonged to Spain. Just want to make sure that that's really clear.
I like that.
Please duly note that in the oral history.
Yeah, it is. It is duly noted. So, how was the? You said you took classes, basically a class or two a year before to transition into a certain extent. But how was it getting here and you were here, but being a full time student on campus that first semester?
It was great. I mean, I loved. The life of the mind and studying, and it wasn't every class wasn't everything that I wanted, but it sure was pretty cool to spend my time studying and thinking about the world as it had been and was, and what it could be, and that was my whole point in coming to graduate school and law school, again, to appropriate some of the skills and a view and a perspective to contribute to what I felt needed to happen in a labor movement for the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was, it's like boot camp. It's like training. It's preparation. And there's a certain degree of excitement when you're in that. Sure, it's intense, and there are times when you're like, why do I have to do this econ assignment or prepare for this exam? And it's stressful, and you want to do well on it. But, it was all for something that I was driving towards. It was great.
Right. So, again, just to briefly back up, when you moved to Madison, where did you, and I assume your lady friend, where did you and your lady friend live?
We first lived in an apartment in Fitchburg, just off of... Fish Hatch down by PD, and then we moved from there to a house on Spruce Street in the Bayview area.
How did you you said you signed a card before coming before coming back to school?
Yeah.
Do you recall when you first became actually involved in TAA stuff?
Oh, yeah, right away. I mean, the fall, the summer even before I was on campus, I just started getting involved in the work of the union. And I knew that that was something I was going to do. It was sort of like a ringer. Mm-hmm. And got involved in, the organizing work, the political work of the union. And joined the executive board, actually, prior to even starting school and classes. I was elected to be the chair of one of the committees.
That's sort of a meteoric rise.
In the glorious world of grad student worker union politics. The annals of history are now recording my exploits and feats.
But it sounds like you were able to balance the academic part of going to school and then the activism, the TAA part.
Mm-hmm. Is that a... my wife may have a slightly different view of things, but yeah, absolutely. And, for as long as I can remember, I have had a capacity and willingness to just work harder than anyone else that I know of, and be pretty intense about it, and that probably gets me in trouble sometimes. But I was willing to do whatever it took for as long as it took to, make sure that I was advancing the work of the union, of the movement, while still doing my school things and all that. And it helps too, in graduate school. And when I first came to campus. This is the nature of the dual degree program, is you do 1 year of grad school and 1 year of law school, or vice versa, and then you mix and match courses till you finish, and then you do your requirements and your writing and such. So I did a year of grad school first because, law school is just, frankly, it's more intense than grad school. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do my first you know, when I hit campus, it also happened to be at the time of a presidential election, and I wanted to be able to spend a lot of time working on that. And I knew that, you know, the first year of law school it'd be tougher to have that much more discretionary time, you know, for the work of the union. So anyway, that, you know, that might have helped a little bit too, mm-hmm. just being in grad school. And it certainly helps that, you know, when you're in grad school, there's it's not just going and doing required courses. It's like, you know, you actually like the things that you're studying. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
So what work did you do on the 2008 election?
Well, we built a pretty amazing political program inside the TAA that I'm, you know, really proud of to this day. Just engaging and mobilizing our members and then other members of the state federation of which we were part, AFT Wisconsin, to go out and do the grassroots work that it takes to win elections. And, you know, obviously in 2008, a lot of people were really thinking about and focused on electing Barack Obama to be the next president. but for the TAA as a union of people employed by a university that is a creature of the state, it was really important to me that we make a significant impact on some state legislative races. This is at the time when the Democrats were about to take over the majority in the Assembly after having done so in the Senate in 2006. And obviously, there was a Democratic governor then. So this presented itself as potentially an opportunity to make major progress in Wisconsin by having Democrats in charge. There would at least be some room to maneuver instead of, you know, obstruction from the Republicans or, as we see right now, just, you know, an all-out assault that puts working people on the defensive. So we worked to, getting members activated, coming out to the office literally 7 days a week to phone bank or to canvas. We made an impact on a number of state legislative races and made sure that we got all the credit we deserve for it with leadership in the state legislative body so that we would be able to translate that into some concrete gains. It's the nature of public sector unionism that it's intimately tied to the political arena, and we use that to the best of our ability to, you know, advance the material standards of the union and of the membership. It wasn't really something that had been done tremendously in the TAA before and hadn't had, like, there wasn't, like, a history of a really disciplined, systematic, rigorous political program, and that was, something I take credit for helping to build there. And that was pretty great for people to then see, like, oh, you know, we built a great program that moved people, and now mm-hmm. now we can go and use some of the clout or influence from that to make further gains, which we did.
How did you know how to do that, or how did you know that that's what you wanted to do?
How did I know that that's what I had wanted to do? Those are two different questions, so right. Maybe I should answer them separately.
Yeah, please do.
You want me to do that? Okay. Yep. How did I know how to do it? There's a few things in this world that I'm pretty good at and have a savant-like ability to figure out very quickly any things that I don't know, and organization building and politics and moving workers is sort of all together. That's one. And I'd done organizing work prior to this, and knew how to put together a political program, and I knew the state political scene pretty well. I'd been an activist before that when I was living in Madison, and it was no great feat to be able to put together, you know, a really solid, strong political program. And, you know, part of it too is just being willing to work harder than anyone else, just, you know, staying at the office till 10 at night or whatever, getting things done. And I could just wax boring for a while about some of the nuts and bolts, but I don't think that's particularly interesting. But how did I know that's what I wanted to do? I like to think that I'm a fairly thoughtful and contemplative person who considers the world as it is and where I think it ought to be and what I can do about it and come up with a way to make that happen. And, it seemed to me that it would be extremely important, no matter what, as essentially a state employee union for the TAA, that we have some political power, as we're going to be doing, you know, further contract negotiations and being able to, you know, advance and make progress on our other agenda. And one of the things that I really like about, you know, that union that I was a part of there is I think we took a pretty broad view of the role of the union representing its membership. And, you know, so part of that is representing student workers as workers and as students. And so, you know, we knew that an issue of segregated fees was something we'd likely have to deal with through a comprehensive effort, including in the political arena. And so, you know, it was pretty clear to me on a number of different fronts that we needed to build a political program. And, you know, this is a true statement wherever you are, whether you're talking about state employee unions or, you know, other public sector workers, working people generally, or, you know, even outside that realm. For most people, that which is political at least starts with elections and legislation, as opposed to the glorious contest for authoritative power in a democratic society in name. So there's like, there was an opportunity there because of the heightened importance and the possibility for you know, electoral change in 2008, that there would be a crop of people that we could engage amongst the TAA membership and amongst the AFT membership to get involved in the union. Because there was some salience and some of the political work and some consciousness about what was happening, and a real zeitgeist, I think, for people, you know, becoming activists. So it was instrumental for some of the agenda gains on the agenda of the union, but also in terms of building the union itself for the longer term. It was a vehicle for that, and that's how I identified it, at least, to build for the future. And, you know, I think it played out for the most part.
You talked about seg fees. Were you here during the first campaign to try to renovate, I think it was the NAT and other other similar places, so the recreational facilities?
There was two Union South seg fee fights just before my time. Then the NAT one, I ran the campaign. I came up with a campaign to beat it. The No New Seg Fees campaign. If you'd like a t-shirt, I still have a bunch in my closet.
Oh, cool.
The green ones. Mm-hmm. They're kind of ugly, but they really served a purpose. Yeah, that was the largest student voter turnout in the history of the UW system to that point. But like two times over. Mm-hmm. And we won the referendum on that 2-1. That was part of a long-term campaign. Like I said before, a comprehensive effort to take on segregated fees is, you know, a backdoor tuition hike, a material degradation of the conditions of students, and just sort of very much a practical expression of the privatization, corporatization of the university, the advent of neoliberalism in the academy, the idea that, you know, there's market relationships involved in the access to education and what is part of the experience in an academic setting. So, you know, there was this larger fight about the, you know, the core values, the fundamental values, the priorities of the academic community, the university community, and again, of a democratic society. Access to affordable quality public education is pretty much a given, at least it should be. But also a really practical fight that people come access. You can't run a campaign against neoliberalism and corporatization. You can run a campaign to beat back its practical expressions, like segregated fees. and the campaign that took that on, and I have a whole rap about this, and I'll probably end up taking you through a little bit of that through some of these questions, but the work that was done in that campaign very much directly followed from the activity in the organization built in some of the political work in 2008. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, general activism of the union and on campus and in the political arena. And then a conscious effort to build, an alliance of left-oriented student groups with the TAA providing a little bit of a center, in that the TAA had resources, physical financial personnel that could, you know, buoy some of this. And then that in and of itself was part of a bridge towards building a broader student worker alliance that was taking on some of these bigger issues about the nature of the university and the public sector, which is also the clear and direct path to how there was this uprising. How's that for whetting your appetite for future discussion?
That is an appetite whetting, yes. So, to come back to the academic part, just so we have it down for sure. So, you're in graduate school, you're in the TAA. Mm. Do you actually have a teaching assistantship that first year?
I was doing the first year was a fellowship, and then after that, I ended up this is juicy. I ended up with a project assistantship through the School of Public Affairs, mm-hmm. that was essentially a contract with AFSCME District Council 40, which is the County and Municipal Employees Union for 71 of the 72 counties, and I was working in the research department there essentially. It was like a PA ship through La Follette that was loaned out to a public sector union. And so I did research on collective bargaining and legislation and all kinds of things.
And so that would have been the second year then, the fall of 2010?
That sounds about right.
Or you came fall of 2008, so more like fall of 2009 maybe?
Oh, no, I was still on, essentially a grant fellowship for the first year of law school. So that would have been after that. It would have been the next year after that.
Okay. So then you did graduate school the fall of the first year.
The first year.
And then you did law school.
The first year of law school.
That would then be the second year.
Yep.
And then you got this PA.
And then I was in doing grad and law school courses together.
Okay. So then if this is the fall of 2010, this PA ship that you have researching what sounds like just the type of things you want to research is also coming around the time of the 2010 election.
Yeah.
God,
what a disaster that was.
What did the... So what was the difference in your mind between what you and the TAA were doing in 2008 and what was done in 2010?
We still tried to run a great... an effective program, and I think considering the circumstances, we did. But the circumstances were dramatically different. The grounded realities of 2010 differed so much from 2008 that it's almost incomparable. I mean, this is coming on the heels of, you know, for people of the left like me, you know, extreme frustration with what has been happening at the national political scene, which always filters down into state and local things. Tremendous disappointment for people of the left like me who care deeply about state and local politics and seeing what was happening in our capital in terms of having a Democratic majority in the Assembly and the Senate and a Democratic governor that were just totally unable or unwilling to deliver on major things. And coming on the heels of an economic crisis where it seemed like the elected Democratic leadership was just, again, totally unwilling or unable or so compromised that, you know, they would only take not even half measures to address this, you know, raging economic and social crisis going on, but then would paint a bunch of happy talk about, no, things are great, things are working. I mean, it was inevitable that this revanchist right-wing backlash was going to come, and it was accelerated by the ineptitude of you know, political elites, left of center political elites. And so you've got general failure in the governing arena, a tremendous frustration amongst those who would or could be activists, and then amongst the strata of people who are marginally engaged in politics, just sort of, checking out in a lot of ways. So it was very difficult to build a powerful grassroots force, which is what we could do. I mean, we're the Teaching Assistance Association. It's not like we had a bunch of money to throw around. It's only people power. And so, you know, it was a very different situation. We struggled admirably. I should say this. I mean, one thing that was really important to us as grad student workers and to the union is that while the Democrats were in power, we were able to pass a landmark expansion of collective bargaining rights, ironically, for research assistants that both expanded collective bargaining rights for that 2,700 people who had been without rights, and was going to be one of the major advances in academic worker unionism at the time, and along with the, and not just in Wisconsin nationally, but that was also paired with an expansion of collective bargaining rights for faculty and academic staff, which was crucial for professional and academic white-collar worker unionism. And with the research assistant collective bargaining rights authorization, we also won the first majority sign-up and neutrality law in Wisconsin history. And so there was, you know, at least for people like me, where this sort of thing is really important and matters, you know, there was some satisfaction with what some of the Democratic legislative leadership had done, and a number of them had really delivered for us because of the political work that we had done in 2008. But that's not something you can go to your average, ordinary, everyday TA and be like, but the Democrats delivered on this major gain for the union that ultimately, in 5 years' time, is going to reap major material benefits for grad student workers. And you may not be here to see it, but, you know, the people of your kind will benefit from it. It's not easy to make that case to anyone, even if you can say, like, look, people before us fought and sacrificed tremendously so that they could win tuition remission in our contract. People before that fought tremendously and sacrificed greatly to be able to win the right for us to have a union. It's really hard to go out to people in a situation like 2010, but also just generally otherwise, and essentially sell them on an insider view of you know, the arc of movements and their place in that, and then move them to action. Because it doesn't feel like there's a real self-interest in getting involved in the struggle at that point in time. Especially if you're trying to finish up, write your thesis, prepare for prelims, whatever else it is. Mm-hmm. So there's always built-in challenges with grad student worker unionism, just like, you know, anywhere else. But, you know, 2010 was an extremely difficult period to do politics for people anywhere left of center. And you know, the other part of this is Tom Barrett was an extremely weak candidate, and being a resident of the city of which he is mayor, it's eminently apparent in the day-to-day practice. And, you know, I think this is a, you know, maybe a conversation for us to have over beers and not necessarily with a microphone, because it's maybe not all that interesting, or people who would listen to this have probably already come to their own conclusions about it. But, you know, it's a reflection of the you know, the fundamental weakness of the American left in terms of having an electoral strategy, and it's a comment on the fundamental flaws of the Democratic Party writ large, which is not a monolith, and I say that as someone who was at one point in time an elected member of the state party executive committee. You know, we got our ass kicked because Democrats didn't put forward any sort of real agenda for working people, and Scott Walker won the economic argument. Now, it's an economic argument that I disagree with vehemently, that if we put more money in the hands of corporations and the rich, that it will trickle down. We know that that doesn't work empirically, and it's also just morally objectionable. But it's not like there was an alternative put forward by Tom Barrett or anyone else, and really hasn't been amongst the Democrats at the elite level for decades. So all that came together to make 2010 just a total disaster. From the governor's race to the state legislative races and more, and that put us in an extremely difficult position. I remember sitting at a bar on the west side of Madison that night when election returns were coming in, and, you know, for those of us who had been really working on it, we already knew what the results were. We just didn't know how bad they were going to be, and the political director for AFSCME at the time was sitting at the table with me, and he looked at me and said, well, looks like everyone in Wisconsin is going to have to learn what right to work means in our state. And some of us, you know, activist and organizer types who were there, were already starting to talk about, well, what can we do to fight back against the inevitable attacks that are coming? And we didn't know what they were, but we knew they were going to be.
So, I mean, you just said this, but I want to make sure we clarify.
Yeah.
You being on the inside, saw the writing on the wall. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but it sounds like you saw the writing on the wall that there was going to be a change, at least at the governorship level, at least at the gubernatorial level, even before, you know, the first Tuesday in November, you knew this was going to happen.
Yeah, it was just a matter of how badly we were going to lose and if we were going to end up with, you know, 45 seats in the assembly or 35 seats. If we were going to end up with, you know, a near majority in the state Senate or enough of a deficit that the Republicans could just slam through an agenda over the objections of the so-called moderates. It was really just a matter of degrees. And that's what we're fighting for. those of us who believe in electoral politics. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to get to this yet, but I have what I think is a somewhat interesting story in terms of this, like, hindsight is 2020. There were some of us who actually did have a pretty clear view of what might come to be. So,
well, if it's let's get it now while it's on your mind. So if you want to continue on this path, go ahead.
I don't think I will ever forget it. So okay. There's no urgency. I think a lot of people who paid attention to some of this know that after the disastrous elections between the first Tuesday in November and the swearing in of Scott Walker on January 4th, there was an attempt to conclude, certainly for state workers, contract negotiations for the 2009 to 2011 biennium to, you know, basically extend contracts for another 6 months while Walker was in office. And, you know, many of us were furiously negotiating to get to resolution, and many of us were extremely frustrated and saying, aha, I told you so, that those contracts had not been negotiated previously, but it's not like Jim Doyle was ever sort of all that interested in, negotiating with state worker unions in any sort of real and direct way. But in any event, Joe Winicky, who had been appointed the head of the Office of State Employment Relations, is a decent human being and someone that I knew. And so I'd been trying to work through some back channels with him and with members of the state legislature who ran on our behalf to conclude negotiations for a TAA contract while our bargaining team was going to the table and meeting resistance and all that. And it just so happened that as this was going on, our union, the TAA, was part of a group of AFT-affiliated grad student worker unions. The TAA was the nation's oldest grad student worker union, but by no means the sole one. And so every fall and spring, that group of AFT-affiliated grad student worker unions would get together and have a conference. And it was coming up that I think it was the weekend right after the election, or maybe the weekend right after that, in Ann Arbor. So I'd driven there with a car full of people, and a bunch of us were there. And, I was just burning up my cell phone battery, you know, trying to deal with this back channel negotiations on the contract. And and then, you know, that Saturday afternoon hit, and, you know, other people being normal humans being were like, well, I think I'll take the rest of the weekend off. And so, I was, you know, agitated and jittery. And one of my close friends and mentors, the president of the faculty union at Milwaukee Area Technical College, AFT Local 212, his name is Michael Rosen, and he's a fellow radical. He and I had said, oh, well, let's talk sometime this weekend when we have some free time. And I, you know, had originally sort of begged off a little bit, like, you know, Michael, I got to make sure I deal with all this stuff, and I'm at this conference, and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, no, we'll figure it out. So there was a two-hour period in the conference after, you know, I sort of been unable to continue back channel negotiations where other people in the conference were going to go do something that I really had no interest in. So I got on the phone with Michael, and we talked for almost that whole 2 hours. November 10th, I remember it clearly. We were, taking up this question of where's there going to be any sort of resistance. And, you know, our analysis was that, you know, working people, you know, from the high level, the grand scheme of things, working people, poor people have been so beaten down that there's been virtually no resistance and no fight back. And, you know, part of the nature of social movements and upsurges and uprisings is that, people are not going to take, when things get bad, things get bad. When things get worse, things get worse. That's not like, well, if things get bad enough, the people will fight back. That's just bullshit. That's not the nature of history. And it's not the nature of human beings, and anyone who's actually gone out and tried to organize to take on real substantive fights would be able to tell you that. So being the hardened organizers and activists that we were, Michael and I were sort of wrestling with what that implied and sort of where there's a potential for some militancy. And, you know, we both sort of agreed, and I don't think this is too brilliant, but that any sort of uprising was going to have to come from the campuses and the proximity of UW to the state capitol, but also of the nature of the TAA and the fact that we had some organizing infrastructure and leadership meant that, you know, we would probably have to play a special role in this and that we needed to set ourselves out right away for, you know, building for a tremendous fight back. And we didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but we probably needed to figure out a way to engage the potential masses of students around a struggle that mattered, and start to build to make that sort of a defining point in you know a resistance to Walker, a fight back against the Walker agenda, which had a clear path to maneuver forward. So you're right that hindsight is 20/20, and many of us could look back and say like, oh well, yeah, we should have seen that he was, you know, out for blood with public employee unions and collective bargaining rights. I don't think anyone's realistic if they say that, but there are some of us who had a very clear view, and I don't think this presents us as any sort of sage. Or, you know, brilliant, farsighted people. You know, most of us, I think, who are involved in serious politics think that, or thought that, you know, Walker was going to push a dramatic and extreme agenda, and that it was going to be militant and uncompromising, and that anyone who thought of, you know, conventional politics or had conventional wisdom or views about it was just going to be totally proven to be utterly out of touch with reality, in that, like, oh, well, he won't overreach. I mean, yeah, he's got huge majorities, and he's a reactionary right-wing, you know, quasi-fascist, but he's not going to go full Monty. I mean, he'll face an electoral backlash. I just don't think that's the nature of American politics. But I think many of us knew that this was coming, and we needed to steel ourselves for it and figure out a way to organize for a resistance and a fight back. And there were other people as well who did this, but I think we had a view very clearly early on to build something on campus.
Okay. So I've got a few more minutes left.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to back up to the no seg fees, particularly the NAT.
Yeah.
Because I've interviewed a couple of people who have talked about that, so I want to get as much sort of context as I can. So I wonder if you could walk me through, you said it was, well, let's walk me through starting with when you knew, or when as a CA you knew that this was coming, and then how you reacted to it.
So for many of us, segregated fees had been identified a long while previous as like a major issue, because with tuition remission in our contract, that's a crucial material benefit. And when wages for TAs and PAs were so low, like having tuition remission is it almost makes up for that. Mm-hmm. Segregated fees were, you know, being used institutionally as a, you know, as I said before, as a backdoor tuition hike, and this ideological thing about the privatization of universities, which was morally objectionable, personally abhorrent, whatever, abhorrent to us. But it was also, you know, almost $1,000 a year out of our pockets. And so that had been a major priority in terms of bargaining, which, you know, what we weren't making gains on, we knew we weren't going to. And, you know, we had pushed a little bit of a legislative strategy and tried in the state budget to do some things with having the state put money into a fund to pay segregated fees on behalf of grad student workers, and basically force it into the contract that way. And, you know, again, this was going to be something that would take a while to address segregated fees as they were. Mm-hmm. And now there was this proposal to take them from where they were and increase them even more for something to that was, seemingly asinine. A new gym? I mean, this is a world-class university that is slowly being pecked and scratched and clawed apart and systematically defunded from the people down State Street. And you want to use millions of dollars from students, thereby compromising access to this world-class institution for the people of this state, to build a fucking gym? I mean, this just doesn't compute, and any sane and rational person looking at it objectively, you know, from the outside would have been like, God, that's a really dumb idea. And then you sort of have to wonder, what the hell was the administration thinking? And so I think that was our view, is, you know, part of the fight to, you know, and this is, again, the nature of history and social movements, is that oftentimes those that make the biggest gains and make the furthest advances by going on offense are the ones that are rooted in playing defense first and using that as a way to put forward a view and a frame and an analysis of the problem that points to a solution that enables people to go from defense to offense. Now, just for what it's worth, I don't advocate constantly playing defense in the world of movements, and in fact, for much of the left, that is a consistent problem. But this was a real opportunity to take on a defensive battle in a strategic way to then go on offense about segregated fees. And so it was, you know, I think a really important and strategic choice to say, we are going to take this fight on and then use it as a way to build, you know, essentially an anti-seg fee front here in on campus. And so would have been like late winter, early spring when things really started to come together and we had a, you know, essentially a committee of activists and leaders from other student organizations coming together to work on some things coming out of spring break. We wanted to have things together. There was some student government elections as well, too, that, you know, we started to intervene in beyond just the seg fee thing. But, you know, we put together a pretty decent, I would say, a very good campaign and had a strategy for reaching students as voters, turning students into voters and propagandizing and moving votes, just like, you know, you would in a political election. An earned media strategy, you know, a way to tell our story in the campus press. And there was a growing campus politics blog and a blogging scene at the time. And then, you know, we were able to stumble on some interesting information that a reporter from the Associated Press was willing to run with. And I spent a lot of time on the phone sort of walking him through what was going on and why it was objectionable. And to this day, I think my fingerprints are still off that story in public, but I'm outing myself now. Not that it's really outing, but, you know, that the administration had spent, you know, something like $30,000 on this Add Up campaign that was this really sort of ridiculous, overproduced grass, AstroTurf campaign by UW administration, the athletic department, whatever else, rec sports, to convince students to vote to increase their segregated fees to build this gym for them. And so when we exposed that, that created a whole shitstorm. And, you know, and we just ended up running a better grassroots and field campaign the other side didn't have. And, you know, we moved a lot of people to come out and vote and had like a great get out the vote operation on the days of the voting. And, you know, we had a wonderful social media campaign as well, too. You know, that few thousand people like following us. We had an email system that could reach all the UW student voters. And
so what was the... what was social media at that time you were using? What were some of the platforms you were using?
Facebook.
Okay.
I think the No New Seg Fees page is still up, although I may have deleted it. I don't remember. It dwindled in terms of the followers, though. Mm-hmm. You know, people just unliked it or whatever.
So I want to make
and the T-shirts. The T-shirts are crucial here.
Want to make sure we get the T-shirts on
green
on the
T-shirts
record again.
Oh my god! Yeah.
I mean, that had to be a bit of an expense, though.
Totally, and this is the value of having, you know, an institution around that had resources. The Teaching Assistants Association, as a union of students and workers, was able to be a place physically for us to have a campaign out of. So there's a campaign office. It had a copier. It had computers and phone lines. That matters. it was built in. We had, you know, because of the dues paid by the members of the union, we had, you know, flexible resources to be able to print up literature and purchase T-shirts and, you know, even buy a list. I think we bought a list to be able to communicate with all the students with a wisc.edu email address. Like, those flexible resources mattered tremendously in that campaign. We had two part-time staff for the union who we could, you know, basically assign for the 6-week period of the campaign to work, you know, a bunch of their time on winning the referendum. And that meant they were helping to organize other grad student workers and members of the union to go and participate in things. Like, you know, grassroots politicking, you know, campaigns and organizing is not just spontaneity. It's, you know, directly related to, you know, what sort of resources can be put into things. So that really mattered. And obviously that's something that, you know, sort of touches on what Act 10 did in terms of taking away dues deduction. and all that, and a contract. But yeah, it definitely cost money, but we were able to bring that to the table and, you know, absolutely thrilled to be able to do so at the time because it was a great fight to have and it really did set us on the right path. And there's there's a really clear connection between what happened in that fight on the Nonu Seg Feasting, building a, you know, essentially a revived student left on campus, connecting to this fight around a view for what the university ought to be and could be, and building a student worker alliance, and then going from there into the things that were being done on that, you know, the campaign that was coming out of that, that you know, the switch flipped to make it about collective bargaining rights for public employees when this whole shit went down. And, you know, again, this is a preview for next time, and don't think that it's, like, going to escape my mind. But, I firmly and sincerely believe that because the first people to take militant direct action at the Capitol were students, and it cast a non-traditional actor light on what was going on, it opened a whole political space for what the protests could be, and that this could be something that was accessible to the broad masses of people in Wisconsin. And you could have people like my dad who came down to protest, not because I was there so much as it was okay for someone who wasn't a public employee with skin in the game to say this is outrageous and this is an attack on values and priorities that have existed in Wisconsin traditions for a long time. Because, you know, students were on the front lines of that at first, or what were seen as students, even though many of us were workers too, and had something to lose. It created a different political space than if it had been, you know, quote unquote, whiny public employee bureaucrats. No offense to present company intended here. Adopting the rights language. If it had just been, you know, state civil servants who made wages high above the median in Wisconsin and had good benefits saying, hey, stop attacking us, it would have been crushed immediately with no real upsurge, no activity. But because it was of a different political character, which again directly related to the organizing and base building work that had been done and the campaigning done leading up to that, that a switch was able to be flipped to transition what we were doing around access to quality, affordable public education and the nature of the university to, look, we have to defend the workers who make this university happen and their rights, and the political education we've done with students around the role of unions and collective bargaining rights and its link to social movement history. Anyway, we can talk much more about that later, but just have to say that from Nonu Seg Feast to the uprising, there's a clear direct line.
Peter, before we shut down today,
did we make it through what, a half the questions you wanted to?
I think we got half at least.
Okay.
Is there anything on your mind, not that you won't be able to say it the next time or remember it, particularly about the time you started with the TAA until, let's say, you know, the inauguration of Governor Walker? So anything from, you know, the fall of 2008 through early 2011 if you want to talk about, we can talk about it now, or if it comes to your mind, we can make sure we address it.
I don't think it's that big a deal to talk a lot about, but there was a real vibrant and lively debate inside the union about, you know, the future of the union that I think ultimately got some people to be engaged, and, you know, people on opposite sides of the debate from me on some of these things about, you know, how we use dues money. Mm-hmm. And sort of what we're pushing for and how. And, I think there were some interesting things that came out of that just in terms of people getting involved in developing a view of unionism. Like I said, even though they're on opposite sides of the debate from me, and, you know, my side won. I'm glad that we had the debate. Probably I'm glad because, you know, my side won to a certain extent. But it got some people involved in the union, and you know, that's the nature of democratic unionism, something I was really proud of within the TAA, that, you know, we were a radical, militant, democratic union of the members.
All right, well, let's wrap it up today. So okay. This concludes the first interview with Peter Rickman. Thank you, Peter, for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.